Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. More than 2,200 Pennsylvanians died of opioid overdoses in 2016. Not a week goes by that we don't hear of an overdose death. Almost everyone knows someone who is or has been dependent on pain medications or heroin. And now there are much more powerful and deadly substances to talk about. Sometimes it seems like the opioid crisis will never be solved, but there are many organizations and people trying to find out what works. Print, digital, and broadcast news outlets across Pennsylvania are collaborating on a new project called State of Emergency, Searching for Solutions to Pennsylvania's Opioids Crisis. Joining us today to talk about it is Kate Barron, Vice President of Content with Penn Live and the Patriot News. She's one of the editors of the project, Emergency, Searching for Solutions to Pennsylvania's Opioid Crisis. Kate Barron, welcome to the program.
Hi, Scott. Thank you so much for having me on.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So, Kate, what was the idea behind this project?
Well, this all began last summer when I read the book Dreamland, which I know you had focused on, I think, 2 months ago in your Book of the Month Club. And I was really struck by the whole history of opioids, how they developed into such a scourge. And meanwhile, at Penn Live and the Patriot News, like WITF, we have all been covering this topic for going into two decades. And the stats just kept coming out, and they were getting more grim by the minute. And Pennsylvania seems to really be at the center of this. It's been ranked fourth worst state in the nation for overdose death. So we knew we've had this continuing problem. We have all covered it in every possible angle. We were trying to decide, what do we do now? Because I was very concerned that kind of a numbness would set in with people because they'd been seeing so much on the opioids crisis that I just wasn't seeing enough attention being called to it.
I actually have had some people say to me, you talk about this way too much.
Exactly.
And that's exactly what you're describing of people becoming numb to it. It's too big to become numb to.
Yeah. And I was trying to think, okay, how do we break through that? How do we get people's attention? And I was, this is not an original idea. I had been very much admiring a project that happened out in the Bay Area in San Francisco. The Chronicle out there organized a week-long blanket coverage of their homeless problem in San Francisco. And again, it was a way to look at an intractable problem that has been with us forever, but really focusing a new light on it. So I went to Penn Live and the Patriot News sponsor a journalism seminar at the Pennsylvania News Media Association every fall. It's in honor of Sharon Johnson. Some of your listeners might recall.
I remember
she was a wonderful, wonderful theater and movie critic for us that really had a very untimely death. Anyway, we've sponsored this seminar now for about 15 years, and every year we try and come up with a new subject. So I thought, why don't we do how to cover the opioids crisis in a new way? We had a great turnout. Over, I think, 50 journalists from all around the state came to PNA for the day and heard sessions from first responders, from former addicts, from families who had lost loved ones, government officials. I know the Attorney General was there. Just the whole range of people who are really invested in fighting this epidemic. And at the seminar, I posited the question, hey, would people be interested in getting together across the state to do a very intensive coverage boost of opioids? A lot of enthusiasm, but one thing that really came out was people wanted to kind of look on the positive side. Okay, we've had the dire stats. Now let's do something about what's working or what's showing promise, what's showing potential. As I say, there's no quick fix to this problem, obviously, but we wanted to focus on what solutions were being tried and experimented with all around the state. So I got a sturdy band of editors together from, LNP was there, Allentown, Scranton newspaper, Bucks County, and we all met at Allentown at Terry Rang's shop and talked for about a morning on how do we present this. We then got support from two newspaper groups and two media groups in the state, PSNE and APME, and also Associated Press in Philadelphia really bought into the project. Then we contacted editors at papers, at websites, you folks at WITF, a lot of public radio and TV really stepped up on this to say, please send us your stories that highlight potential solutions, things that could be happening that people would want to know about, that they'd want to share, could maybe be inspired by. And the outpouring was, I was floored by it. It was terrific. We were able to get stories and content from, oh gosh, I think AP counted at least 50 media companies, and we've covered most of the state.
Mm. Yeah, I had seen that Pennsylvania has 67 counties. I think we were up over 60 counties that where there were participants. And probably some of those counties even have weekly newspapers or something like that.
Oh, yes, so the weeklies were all in, starting with Middletown Press and Journal.
Yes, yes, one of the best weeklies in the area. So other than so many media collaborating on a project. First of all, has that ever happened before?
We've been through this to a smaller degree with something that we called state secrets. It was auditing Pennsylvania's open records law, where mainly the press companies, PSNE and PAPME, would get together and go around and see how tough is it to get open records in Pennsylvania. We've done that three times. That worked out very well, but it was on a smaller level. So we're not foreign to that idea. What I think made this really work was, interestingly enough, Pennsylvania has a lot of editors in place at their newsrooms who have been there a long time, and we tend to all know each other. So yes, we're healthy, good-natured competitors, of course. That's what really makes us tick. But on the other hand, we're also able to call somebody up, and you call Philadelphia, and Stan will say, yeah, we'll get on board. And you call Pittsburgh, and you call different outlets, and everybody jumped on board this because we have that collegiality now.
Mm. So this isn't a precedent setting, but what it does make it unique is that so many media are participating.
Yeah, the size.
But what you just touched on also makes it unique in that talking about solutions, that the focus is on solutions.
Right.
What are some of, now you've seen probably all of these stories.
I have indeed, all 70 of them.
Oh, and there's 70 so far?
Yes.
So what sticks out to you that is working across the state?
Well, there are some common denominators throughout the state. And the one thing I looked at after I'd read everything was the counties that are banding together, getting different groups to work together in coalitions, in support networks, are the ones that are really making progress. And I'll just share some of the stories that we have in this package, which is available online, and I'll give the URL in a minute. But it's also been appearing in papers across the state since Sunday. I know we're running content through this coming Sunday. There are small solutions. One of my favorite was out of Lackawanna County, a guy who was a former addict who is now in grad school thought, okay, where do people need to find resource information? He got on the idea that it's at the drugstore. It's when people go in to fill their opioids prescriptions, when they go in to get needles. And so what he did was, on his own dime, printed up cards with resource information for Lackawanna County. Then he went around to all the drugstores in that county and asked if they would include these info cards in their bags when they hand prescriptions over for opioids. Sure enough, everybody bought in, and that was just one of those small but mighty steps, I think, that people hadn't thought of before. That was a real favorite with mine. Really some surprising things out in Blair County. The Altoona Mirror did a story on how business leaders in that county have set up a fund over, I think it's the last 3 or 4 years, and contributed over $3 million to go to police services, to go to education, to go to support groups involved in this crisis. Again, these grassroots efforts that really caught fire. Those are two of them. We have big ones, too. I know the Philadelphia Inquirer did a story on controversial safe injection sites.
I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah. Yeah.
That actually is something I'd like to focus on here on Smart Talk sometime, is that, explain that a little bit, because Philadelphia is one of the few. Now, it's happening in some other cities, other large cities, but not here in the heartland.
No, very controversial, and I think there's still a lot of controversy wrapped around it in Philadelphia. In fact, I know there is, but they're trying to get that program off the ground, their argument being, let's do this. You're not going to get rid of these drug addicts, but let's have it where they can be in a safe place when they do inject, with medical care. Other situations, I learned that Cumberland County, the Sentinel, which jumped into this project right away, looked at how really pioneering the drug intervention court is down there in that county, and how it combines not only the justice system, but medication services, again, therapy services, a lot of support. There was a lot of talk about the warm handoff programs that a lot of counties are doing.
And that comes from the state, too.
Exactly.
Governor Wolf, the Wolf administration, has talked about
exactly
that.
Right. I know we did, WPSU did a story on, no, actually, I'm sorry, it was the Daily Collegian did a story on how up in Little Snowshoe, Pennsylvania, up in the hinterlands of Centre County, what those first responders are dealing with and how they're trying to get Narcan out into their kits when they go out and have to treat addicts. So it was a real variety of topics. It was really neat. Juniata County, my old paper, The Sentinel in Lewistown, did a story where Juniata County folks have gone to senior citizens centers all around the county to warn people, hey, look, a lot of opioid abuse starts with people raiding medicine chests, medicine cabinets, and here's how you can dispose of your pharmaceuticals, of your narcotics when you're done with your doses. A lot of interesting stories like that. And we just, the response was so great, and the ideas from big to little were really inspiring.
Our guest during this portion of the program is Kate Barron, Vice President of Content with Penn Live and the Patriot News, one of the editors of the project, State of Emergency, Searching for Solutions to Pennsylvania's Opioids Crisis. It's a collaboration of more than 50 media outlets across Pennsylvania. And we'll get that URL for you in just a moment where you can connect and read those stories. It's just some really good and valuable information. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7000. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Kate, in my introduction, I said that there are very few signs that the opioid crisis is letting up. And, you know, I don't even know quite how to describe it. Every once in a while, you see something. Pennsylvania Cost Containment Council last week had Joe Martin, our executive director, on the program, where he said that one of the things they've seen is just the smallest increase in the number of overdose admissions to Pennsylvania hospitals in like the last 5 years. Still a 12% increase, but that was the smallest increase. I mean, we seem to be searching for anything to latch onto. You see all the stories that come into Penn Live and the Patriot News. You hear, and I almost always want to say every weekend, but it's not just Saturday and Sunday where there are overdoses, but it seems to be more over weekends. Do you see any signs of this letting up at all?
No.
Yeah.
No, I don't. Now, I will say this. I think one reason why we're seeing more and more of it is because people have become very honest about what's going on out there. And we saw it in the obituary pages, where in the past, loved ones would never say, my daughter, who's 22, died of opioid abuse, of an overdose. That nowadays, that's turned a bit. People want to talk about it so that it's out of the closet, so to speak, so that people know just how severe this crisis is, that it touches everybody's lives in one way or another. From the package, Snyder County, the Daily Item, did a story on an obituary for a 22-year-old woman whose parents included poems she was writing while she was struggling with addiction, which unfortunately got the better of her. And that obituary, which they printed in the paper and put up on their website, went viral around the world and really touched a lot of lives. So I think by getting that news out there, by not trying to hide opioid addiction in the shadows, by talking about just how severe this situation is, you see more of it, but then hopefully in turn, there's more response. There's more of a call to action.
Well, and I think that, you know, when you are able to read these stories, hear these stories, that you realize that there are a lot of people out there that this is their focus, and they're trying to come up with solutions. I don't want to make it sound like there is no solution, because we know it is a high hurdle that that this state and the entire country really has to get over to solve this. And it's going to be a long road, but at least there are so many people working on it, so many people, because it has touched so many people.
Yeah, exactly. And this is why we called the project State of Emergency, because that's truly what it is. Yeah. I'll just mention really quickly, first of all, media companies all over the state are running these stories on their websites. At least 24 papers, by my count, last Sunday kicked off the program on their front page. But I want to give you our URL on Penn Live. If anybody hasn't seen the stories and wants to read them, we're putting all 70 up there. It's PennLive.com/opioid-crisis. And it's its own page where you can go and go through all those stories from counties, again, like I said, all over the Commonwealth.
As you well know, we hear from readers, we hear from listeners all the time who have, you know, they critique the stories that we've published or that we've broadcast. One of the things that we heard is that, okay, now when we're talking about this project, we're talking about something that's positive and trying to find solutions. But from time to time, when we would broadcast a story, produce a story that focused on someone who maybe was dependent but overcame that dependency and was now living a happy life and was reaching out and helping other we'd hear from people who say, you know what? You know, this. You're focusing on the success stories. Not everyone is a success story. 2,200 people died. Have you heard those things too?
Yeah, and I've also, there's still that stigma out there that, you know, why are you devoting so much coverage to people? They're just, they're failures in life. They just ignore them. And we've just got to counteract that. Oh, yeah, we've had a huge dose of the grim statistics and the stories of people that have not been able to shake it. I mentioned the whole phenomenon in the obituary pages. But again, there is so much more going on that is giving some hope because people are paying attention now. And again, it started with the state making its declaration, I think it was late last year, moved on to everybody just really focusing on a problem that is far from over.
Yeah, we have a comment here from a listener who says that some use by choice. They need to be responsible for that choice. I don't think that the stories I've seen, anyone ignores that. That when they say choice, I think that what she's saying here is that it somehow was a moral letdown or that this person was weak. And we've heard all those things. But the fact is that once someone becomes dependent, doesn't matter. They're dependent. It's disease, and they've got to find a way to kick it. And either that or they die.
Absolutely.
Someone here says that returns his unused pills to the pharmacy. Much pain would be better treated in physical therapy if physical therapy was prescribed by doctors. So we have some listeners who are offering some of their own solutions, too. So, Kate, I want to thank you very much for coming on the program and heading up this project. How do we know what has been achieved? Is there anything to measure it by?
Well, there'll be more statistics out. I think they come out later in July for last year, and we'll see what the rates are then. And then I really think it's one person at a time.
That's a kind of a sports cliche of taking it one game at a time. But there's a reason people say that is that you do have to look at each individual and do it one at a time. These are, you know, we often use numbers, but these are people.
Yeah.
These are people, and as we say, that almost everyone knows someone or is in a family where someone has been impacted by this. Kate Barron is the Vice President of Content with Penn Live and the Patriot News, one of the editors of the project State of Emergency, Searching for Solutions to Pennsylvania's Opioids Crisis. Kate, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Scott.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. The Consul General of Canada was in Harrisburg last month and joined us on Smart Talk. This week, Canada imposed tariffs on some American imports in retaliation for President Trump ordering tariffs on steel and aluminum imported from Canada. We'll hear that conversation with Consul General Phyllis Yaffe on today's Smart Talk. It came just days after the G7 summit, where Trump had harsh words for Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. So let's go to that conversation now with Phyllis Yaffe. Madam Consul General, thank you for being with us today.
My pleasure.
As I mentioned, you were scheduled to be here in Harrisburg and actually scheduled to talk with me before last weekend's G7 summit. So a lot has occurred since then. But before we get into the events of last weekend and the issues that it raises, what was your purpose in coming to Harrisburg?
Well, interestingly, it was the same purpose as it is today, and that is to continue to build relationships with our friends in Pennsylvania, to remind people that Canada is first of all, your best customer, not just for the country of the United States, but also for the state of Pennsylvania, and that we have been allies and friends across this border for many, many decades, many centuries, and we will continue to be the best of friends for the future.
You said that you were here to remind Pennsylvanians. You actually met with some leaders of the state, of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, to remind them. What were those conversations like? And I know you have others planned for later.
I think as in all of the states that we work in, New York, Connecticut, New Jersey, Delaware, and primarily here right now, Pennsylvania, we find that the state representatives are generally very knowledgeable about Canada, understand that trade between Canada and their state is an important part of their economy, and also, of course, remember that we have fought wars together. We continue to defend North America together. So, you know, one of the things I like to point out is that in the Eastern Air Defense Command, which is part of NORAD, our defense system for North America, there are 16 Canadian service people sitting at a desk beside American service people watching the skies to make sure that the air traffic control is controlled and safe for passengers from Canada and the United States. Those Canadians sit side by side with Americans doing that very same job, and Americans sit side by side with Canadians doing that job in Canada. So we have been allies. We fight wars together when we need to, but we defend our continent together. So we are the best of friends. And I guess remind is maybe it underlines the fact that we're such good friends that sometimes we forget to remember each other. And so we're here to just remind people.
So when the events of last week occurred, that's not the kind of language that two friends use very often. And I'm going to get into some more specifics about some of the charges made back and forth. But this is unusual for many, many Americans, I'm sure for many Canadians as well, that there would be harsh words between the two nations.
Well, I think I would I disagree on harsh words between the two nations. I would say there were harsh words, but our prime minister was very careful and very focused on being clear about his response, something he said many times before, both publicly and I think privately with the president, that the tariffs that have been imposed on Canada's steel and aluminum industry are based on this process that suggests that Canada is a national security threat to the United States. And he, along with every Canadian, finds that totally implausible. The story I told about the Air Defense Command would, I think, prove that that just in so many ways is not the case today and never has been the case. So his response was very measured, very careful. He said, we are polite, we are careful, but we won't be pushed around. Those were the words he used. And as far as I'm concerned, those don't sound like aggressive words to me. They sound like responsive words and careful words, because nobody from on the Canadian side wants to create a trade war with the United States.
I'm curious what the response has been after the G7 summit in Canada. What are Canadians saying?
Yeah, I mean, it's remarkable. We had a motion in the House of Commons in Ottawa this week, where we had unanimous approval for a response to the words and to the concepts that Canada would be a national security threat and that we are unfair traders. All of that was unanimously discounted by our House of Commons, and unanimous support for the way the Prime Minister has responded, which, you know, takes a lot of control, but he has made sure that we behave the way we always do, and that is to respect our neighbors and to show that we will always be friends and allies And we may have these disagreements, but we'll get over them.
Let's talk about some specific issues that President Trump brought up. The president said that Canada exported $18 billion more in goods and agricultural products in 2017 than it imported. He sees that as a substantial trade deficit.
Yeah, you know, I know that we can all pick apart little pieces of the trade numbers, but the reality is that Canada has a the United States has a trade surplus in goods and services with Canada. The only category where Canada has a surplus with the United States is in oil and gas. And of course, I think America would be happy to know that it had Canada, a stable, friendly neighbor to count on for its energy source, rather than other countries that are far away and may not be as friendly as Canada. So that's the only category where Canada has a surplus. All other categories, we have a deficit. And I appreciate. And by the way, that comes right out of the United States government's numbers. It's nothing Canada makes up. So I can only say that the facts are important to understand when you come to these kinds of numbers.
I understand that often Canadians do quote the American figures rather than the Canadian figures. A key word in what you said was "and services."
Sure.
President Trump seems to use only manufacturing and agriculture when he's talking about trade with Canada. And if you just count those two areas, there is indeed a trade deficit between the United States and Canada, which Canada having the upper hand there, but services. That's kind of hard to measure for many people. I don't know whether that's why the president doesn't count it when he talks about these figures, but how does the government of Canada, when you're talking about trade, count services?
Well, it may be not as easy to visualize, but our accounting firms, the banking industry, the financial services sector, all of that is totally services that we get from the United States, and those and the vast majority of the American economy these days is more services than goods. And I think the reality is, as we all switch to technology, to artificial intelligence, to the computer world that it thrives in Silicon Valley and New York, those industries sell their services. Microsoft, Apple, Google, all of those, Facebook, all of those sellers of services into Canada are what is driving the growth in the American economy. And if you don't want to count those numbers, I suppose you can, parse the numbers to any way you want. But the reality is America's dominant position in services around the world is what is driving the growth in the economy. And honestly, those are the jobs of the future. So I personally would say it's important to count them.
What about, and I'm just going to give an example. I was reading somewhere along the line, a Canadian tourist that comes to the U.S., is that counted as a service?
I think it's counted as trade. I'm not sure it's a service, but it is interesting because so many Canadians do come to the United States and Pennsylvania as well. We have a trade surplus of Canadians coming to Pennsylvania rather than Pennsylvanians coming to Canada.
So let's talk about Pennsylvania in particular. You said earlier that primarily Pennsylvania, I assumed you were talking about today or this week's visit, primarily Pennsylvania. But what are some of the products and services that Canada trades with Pennsylvania?
So we export oil and gas. That's a major export to Pennsylvania and the largest category. But steel and aluminum are very big exports of Canada. But, steel is such an interesting subject because what I've learned, and I have to admit I didn't know this when I took this job, but steel, to just say the word steel belies the fact that there are so many different products within that. So some kinds of products that are steel-based come from Canada because we excel at making those products, and some come from the United States because you make them and have exported them forever. We have a deficit of $2 billion in steel products from the U.S. to Canada. That is, America sells more than more steel and aluminum, more steel products to Canada than Canada exports to the United States by $2 billion. So we are an importer. We're the largest importer of American steel. We buy 50% of all the steel that is exported from the United States comes to Canada. We're your best customer. Canada buys more products from the United States than, and I think this is important to take a breath and remember, Canada buys more from the United States than China, Japan, the UK combined. We are, you know, it's almost $1 trillion of business between the two countries in a year. I think Russia is about $30 billion. So, you know, I just put it in comparison and say we drive your economy and you drive ours, and that has worked for us for a very long time.
Why'd you bring up Russia?
Just somebody told me that number the other day, and I thought that's interesting.
I didn't know whether that was you you were saying that on purpose because the president talked about Russia before the G7 or not.
No, you know, the G7 and the Russia is issue. I mean, we have said very strongly that the Crimean invasion is remains an obstacle to the government of Canada for allowing Russia back into the G8, formerly 8, now 7. And we haven't changed our position on that. We see no difference. I mean, I think being asked, I appreciate that there are many large economies that aren't at the G7 table. But what has made that such an important group is that we share values. And if you allow somebody into that group who has no respect for other countries' territory and values, I'm not sure what the point of that group would be. So that's why we think that it should remain the G7.
I want to get back to Pennsylvania.
Sure.
What are some of the main products that are traded between Pennsylvania and Canada?
Well,
you mentioned oil and gas, which a lot of Pennsylvanians may be surprised because Pennsylvania produces so much natural gas nowadays. But
right.
What are some of the products?
So agriculture is a very large part of it. Chemicals, obviously oil and gas, machinery, forest products, minerals and metals, plastics. You know, I would say across the board, those are imports in, that's $11.7 billion of imports from Pennsylvania imports from Canada. So, and you know, top Pennsylvania goods imports from Canada include the plastics, the aluminum, pharmaceuticals, medicine, and of course our agricultural products like breads and cereals, those kinds of things. We do have a, you know, we have a robust trade that really focuses on all the things Pennsylvania is good at and all the things we need in Canada.
We're going to talk about agriculture in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. We're speaking today with the Consul General of Canada, Phyllis Yaffe, talking about last weekend's G7 summit, trade between the United States and Canada, trade between Pennsylvania and Canada. That's all topics that we'll be addressing during this portion of the program. Madam Consul General, I want to talk about agriculture. President Trump also said last weekend that Canada imposes a 277% tariff on the import of American dairy products. Is that accurate?
There certainly is a category where we have that kind of tariff on imported dairy. But I think what he missed and what others need to understand is that if you step back and look at the whole dairy industry and the relationship between Canada and the United States, last year we imported, Canada sold to the United States about $100 million worth of dairy altogether. But Canada bought from the United States almost $500 million worth of dairy. In other words, you have a $400 million surplus, and we have a tenth of the population you do. We do like your dairy, and we do buy it in huge quantities. So yes, there are categories that are highly tariffed, and we do have a supply management system in Canada. There are many other categories here in the United States that you control and have very high tariffs on. Sugar, is a category that the United States controls very, very strongly. And there are categories that you have very high tariffs on as well. You know, the small fact about the dairy tariff is one that is important to ask, how could we resolve this? And I would say NAFTA is the place where we can resolve it. Trade agreements resolve these things. So making some progress in NAFTA would help us resolve any of these issues. And by the way, when we did our trade agreement recently with Europe, we did resolve that, and we've allowed much more cheese from the from Europe into Canada than we did in the past. The TPP, we've resolved some of our dairy issues. Right, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. We've agreed on changes to our dairy rules there as well. And the United States is not a member of the TPP anymore, but you know, NAFTA is a place where that could be resolved as well. So getting back to the NAFTA table and having that conversation is the way that we can work our way through this.
And I do want to talk about NAFTA because you're playing a role in the negotiations. But getting back to that tariff on dairy products, American dairy farmers, including many here in Pennsylvania, are not doing well right now. There's too much milk on the market. Consumers not drinking as much milk.
Right.
They're not getting the prices that they need. So a foreign market such as Canada would sure look good to them unless there is that huge tariff. Is there any way, and again, this will maybe be part of the discussion on NAFTA, but to try to bring that down somewhat so that it does help the Pennsylvania dairy farmers?
Well, I think you explained it properly. I mean, there is a glut of milk on the market, particularly skim milk, and it's an issue around a universal issue. So our attempt at dealing with that is to control the market, which we do through the supply side. But, you know, Canada exports 1% of the world's milk, 1%. So clearly we're not the creator of the glut. So, I would say, yes, I appreciate absolutely that Pennsylvania dairy farmers are having some issues. And I think there are many ways we can contribute to improving that. But I don't think Canada's tariffs or our supply around the world is causing the issue. I think there is, as there are in many industries, you know, international solutions to this. And NAFTA is one of them. As I said, we did create a better market for European cheesemakers in Canada. But that was through a complete trade agreement that opened up many of Europe's markets to us. As a matter of fact, 400 million people have a free trade agreement with Canada now through that agreement.
President Trump ran for office critical of the North American Free Trade Agreement, saying that it was a bad deal for the U.S. You sit on Canada's Minister of Foreign Affairs NAFTA Advisory Council. What is Canada's position? I know this is a broad question, but Canada's position on NAFTA as we sit here today?
I guess the most important thing to say is we would say NAFTA has been a success for growing trade among the three countries in the agreement. And we have seen trade across the board from Mexico, Canada, and the United States triple since the creation of NAFTA. So obviously we have found a way to trade better because of the agreement. It is 24 years old, and we appreciate that there are lots of things that can be improved in an agreement. And we believe that, as the president did, that it can be modernized. So we have been at the table negotiating in good faith with our two partners, and we will continue to do that because we think an improved NAFTA is a way of creating more wealth and prosperity for people in the middle class, trying to get into the middle class in all three nations. And so, you know, the fundamental issue is, have jobs been lost in manufacturing in North America, in Canada and the U.S. particularly? And the answer, of course, is yes. But, you know, interestingly enough, in Canada, we lost a higher percentage of our manufacturing jobs per capita than the United States did. And so we have to look at, well, what do we do about that? We our solution would be more trade, more opportunities, and retraining some of those people whose jobs have been replaced, not by moving them to other countries, but in many, many instances by technology that has made our companies more productive, more profitable, but hasn't shared as much of the the positive benefits of trade and technology with the people who were workers in their factories, in their plants. So, yeah, let's retrain people and let's give people better jobs, but let's not hope for jobs that have disappeared because of improvements.
You may have just answered this question, but when you say that Canada wanted to modernize this 24-year-old agreement, is that what you were talking about? Is there more to modernizing NAFTA than just that?
No, of course. There are many parts. And by the way, we have concluded about half of the chapters in this agreement with all three countries. So we have been able to sit at the table and make some progress. There are many other parts of the agreement that we think we could conclude quite reasonably in regular trade negotiations. Unfortunately, though, America has asked us to agree to some things that the best way we've described them is unconventional requests. One of them is, and the Prime Minister was very clear about this last week, it was a sunset clause. That is, the entire agreement ends after 5 years and we have to renegotiate, start from scratch. My sense of that is, and I think people in the manufacturing world or wherever would say 5 years, that's hardly enough time to create a business, grow a business, and start to return on my investment anywhere. So, no, I can't invest in the U.S. I can't invest in Pennsylvania for 5 years and then lose my ability to sell there. And so we feel that the notion of a trade agreement is it's an agreement. It lives. And it works. You can fix it and you can review it, but you shouldn't end it. And so that particular request has really been a line in the sand for us. And I'm sure you realize Canadians are bad at drawing lines in the sand. We don't like to do it. But, you know, there is a point, as the Prime Minister said, where we really have to be strong about this one. And so that is one. And the other is dispute resolutions. My history in business was always it's better to put a resolution dispute system in a contract and know how you get over the bad days before you sign it, so you know how to fix it. Today, we're using that dispute resolution mechanism with the United States over these steel tariffs. And obviously, I think it proves the point. Even the best of friends are going to have disputes, and therefore having a system to resolve them is kind of simple. It does give you a place to go. Can it be improved? Of course. And are we willing to discuss that? Sure. But not to abandon it. So, there are more parts of the agreement that we can, I think, make our way through. But there are some that we have to say, you know, at some point, this doesn't work for us.
During these negotiations, and as you said, some of them have completed or there's some reason to be agreed on parts of these, what's Canada willing to give up?
Well, you know, first of all, I'll let the Prime Minister negotiate with the President. But to be fair, that is exactly the question to ask. And I think particularly on agriculture, it is one where we obviously know that there are lots of issues there. We need to support our agricultural industry, as do you, and we will. But when we sit at the table, we would have the conversation that we had with the Europeans. However, as far as I know, we haven't even begun to have the conversation about agriculture. So is that an area where there is some middle ground? I can't answer that, but I can say that we are open to having a conversation about that sector. We haven't been able to get there so far. And, you know, trade agreements often take years to negotiate. So perhaps this is just a part of the process, but we've been at it since last September. It was our hope, and I think America and Mexico's hope, that we could resolve it. There are a lot of political issues on the horizon. Mexico's having an election in July, and of course, midterms come up, and Congress might have a totally different composure after that. But that, you know, that was an impetus to try to move forward faster, and the president was very anxious to move forward faster when we first started. It hasn't worked out, but that doesn't mean that we'll walk away from the table. We will be there.
Something that we never hear about in this country is Canada and Mexico's relationship. Mm-hmm. How does that fit into NAFTA?
You know, I think it was President Reagan who introduced Mexico into the agreement. You know, we were, of course, before NAFTA, we had a free trade agreement with the United States, just the two of us. Mexico joined, and we were happy to do that because we believe that there is, the North American continent includes Mexico, and there are lots of good reasons for us to trade with each other. It is a large market, a growing middle class, and of course that makes a lot of sense in terms of our exports. You know, one thing to know about Canada is we have 36 million people. We have the second largest physical presence of any country in the world, second to Russia. But we have 36 million people. So in our DNA is the need to trade. We just know we have to. And growing our market by adding a country to NAFTA, that makes sense to us. Mexico has 130 million people. So as they move into the middle class and become able to import things from Canada, we would be happy to help them.
Has Canada benefited with trade from Mexico?
Yes. All three countries, I think, have benefited with trade. Is there room to grow? And do we need to, Canada has put forward an agenda. We call it the progressive trade agenda under NAFTA, and it has four categories. The first is labor standards, which we think have to be raised across the board and would certainly have an impact on Mexico. We believe there should be environmental standards that are rigorous, and that too would have an impact on Mexico particularly, I think. We think there should be gender equity and a chapter on that. And we think there should be a chapter on the rights of the indigenous people, which reflects Canada's position, certainly Mexico's position, and some here as well. So, we think of that as a way of moving trade out of that world where people say, well, it didn't help me, to try to spread the benefits of trade to those who are working hard but not seeing those benefits.
We only have a few minutes left. I want to thank you very much for being with us today. This got personal between President Trump and Prime Minister Trudeau last week. How can it be mended?
Well, I think the first response to that is our Prime Minister has worked very hard at establishing a good relationship with the President. I think they do have it, and I think they can return to it. And I think our Prime Minister Trudeau's response, which has been silence, underlines the fact that he will not respond aggressively, and he will not respond irrationally. He will be calm and let this moment pass. And we hope to be able to reestablish that great relationship they had, and also to get back to doing the business at hand, which is in this case, and primarily for now, this NAFTA negotiation.
It's hard to speculate, but President Trump actually suggested that the United States would stop trading with some of the G7 partners. If that were to occur, how would Canada be impacted by that?
Well, I'd say, Canada would be hugely impacted. You are our biggest trading partner. And as much as we import from you, we do sell 75% of our exports to the United States. So, that there lies disaster. So nobody wants to see that happen.
Isn't that an exaggeration? I mean, is that realistic?
Yeah, I think it is realistic. I think we could. Could it happen? Is it possible? I think it's extremely unlikely. One of the things people should really understand about Canada and the United States is trade is probably a misnomer. Our industries make things together. So the industry might create automobiles as a perfect example, where parts are made here, shipped to Canada to be installed, and other parts sent back to the United States as a car and sold here. That car is likely to cross the border with Canada 7 times before it's finished. So when you talk about not trading, it almost doesn't understand what the way we make things together, which is really what the trade between Canada and the United States is. For every dollar we sell into the United States, about 25 cents of that dollar was made in the United States. So you're importing back your own goods, And those created jobs in the United States. If you stopped trading, where would those jobs go? I think it's, of course, it's America is a strong and a vibrant economy with a large population, but the world is a strong and vibrant place as well.
The Consul General of Canada, Phyllis Yaffe, thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Coming up on Monday Smart Talk, we're going to be talking about the state's efforts to eradicate mosquitoes and control West Nile virus.